So when we go back and be aware of any part of our body, it doesn't matter whatever part of the body, the mindfulness of the body will give rise to this effect of mindfulness, to make the mind full again and to harmonize the energy, distribute the energy evenly. And when we are successful, then we will sense a feeling of relaxation happen. This effect of relaxation of our mind and body is the fruit of the practice. If we go back to our breathing, aware of our body, aware of our mind, and during that process of awareness, we feel relaxed. We begin to feel our shoulder release its tension, our back release tension. Then we are successful. We can do this in the sitting position. We can do this in the walking position. Or we can do it in the lying position. When we are sick, when we are our body getting old, and so it cannot support the sitting position anymore, we can very well practice meditation when we lie down completely. Follow the breath, follow the body sensation, and then relaxation suddenly trigger, and healing begin to happen. Many times during the day, let's say like we have been working for 5 or 6 hours or even 3 or 4 hours, but we have a place just to sit down or to lie down and to allow our body to relax, to sense our body and allow that relaxation to occur, then there's a healing in our body happen. And we can go get up and we can continue to go on for the next 5 or 6 hours. It's very good. When we have this feeling of relaxation, it gives us a faith, the faith into our path and the practice. And very interestingly, this effect of relaxation is there in all of the spiritual tradition. Very interesting. There's a professor. His name is Herbert Benson. Herbert Benson. He's the head of the Institute of Mind Body Institute of the Harvard Medical School. Since the early 60s or so, he interest in the effect of meditation on, you know, to the practitioner. What is the physiological response of meditation on the practitioner? So he took his equipment and his team of research to go to India and Tibet, try to measure the monks who do the sitting meditation. And he have the different experiment for the monk, the Tibetan monk who sit in the snow or ice, and they try to practice, and the heat in their body can generate the heat and to melt the ice and the snow around them. And he went to the Quaker group in America. Quaker. Yeah. To study. He went to Hinduist who practice, and he tried to measure, do some type of scientific measurement. He went to the Theravada monk in Sri Lanka, to the monk who practiced Vipassana. He went to a Christian monk who practiced prayer, And he found something very interesting. And he published his research in those many years. He found out that it seemed like all of these practice, they follow a rhythm of repeating act. So let's say someone who practice reciting a mantra, they will recite that mantra over and over again, or they practice, they say Om, Om, Om all the time, or they concentrate on their breathing, or when they concentrate on the prayer, Christian prayer, they just keep repeating their prayer. Then by just this process of repetition, slowly, slowly, it triggers a part of the brain. And when that part of the brain is triggered, before that, there's no activity in that part of the brain. But once that part of the brain is activated, then it begins to send a signal into different parts of the body, and relaxation begins to happen. And he found out a universal core of all of the spiritual tradition. That is, it, all of the spiritual practice try to induce a effect of relaxation in the practitioner. And he wrote a book. The book is called Total Relaxation Response. Relaxation Response. I don't know whether this one has been translated into German or not, but in that 500-page book, he designed one page as a core of his research, as a fruit of his research, is this practice of repetition. So he said that we can just sit down and breathe it in, we can say one. Breathe it out, we say two. So in just one, out of two. And then after a while of just aware of the breathing and say one and say two, suddenly it caused that part of the brain to be activated and relaxation effect happened. And it can heal. Once relaxation happened, it can heal our body. So the idea is like that. When we go back and to be mindful, we begin to induce a process of synchronization in different parts of our being. The synchronization of different streams of consciousness that is flowing into this river of consciousness. And once that synchronization happens, relaxation happens, and healing begins to happen. There's a harmony in the body and the mind. From this result, then people begin to develop into different traditions. Some people interest into the question whether as a human being we can reach the absolute relaxation. And is there an absolute state of the mind which is completely purified, completely independent from this movement of the consciousness? Is it possible to have a complete stillness, complete quiet, complete resting of all these movements? That is one direction that people is searching for. And another direction of the people searching for is that, let's say, if as a practitioner, a spiritual practitioner, should we ever remain in a monastery and try to reach that state of complete stillness, complete of stopping of all of consciousness, or should we continue to live a normal, ordinary human life and try to serve other people and the society. So you see from this, then there begin different branches of school. Then, Zen is a development. Zen is a development due to the cultural background of the Chinese. Before Buddhism go into China, the Chinese only have this idea of tongue. Oh, it's wet. Có cái gì khô đằng sau không sẽ có hả? It's quite wet. Before Buddhism went into China and influenced the Chinese thinking, they only have this idea of tongue. In Vietnamese, I write it like the tongue. They believe that underneath all of these phenomena. All these apparent phenomena. Underneath, there is a essence, a reality that is controlling all of these phenomena. So, in human being, we have tongue. Tongue is the most purified, the most essence, the most living part of our reality. They believe like that. And in the flower, deep within the flower, there's tongue. There's deep within the mountain, there's tongue. So this is a very sentient essence of life within each of the phenomena. It's a tongue. So when Buddhism enter into Chinese, the Chinese try to use the Buddhist practice. Many Chinese, they try to use the Buddhist practice in order to explore the possibility of this tongue, to discover whether we can find this by the Buddhist practice. Can we reach this reality called tongue? So slowly with the with the development of Buddhism in the 6th and the 7th century, and a lot of debate, Zen was born from that movement of searching for tongue. And Zen is a combination of Taoism. So this is Zen. Zen is a combination of Taoism idea, the search for old Chinese belief. And then Buddhist practice. And in the Zen tradition, there's different school again. There are many different school of Zen, not one single, but many form of Zen. They try to reach for this ultimate reality, ultimate mind, the absolute mind. The absolute mind, which is the place where the consciousness completely stops its movement, completely rest, and this just completely stillness part continue to shine, continue to act, but it have gone beyond the control of the movement of consciousness from the source of all of these worldly energy. And that is the direction of Zen. Many Zen, they try to do that. In Japanese Zen, they have a saying something like this: "Tư lượng cá bất tư lượng đề." Tư lượng cá bất tư lượng đề. Bất tư lượng đệ như hà tư lương. Bất tư lượng cá bất tư lượng đệ. Bất tư lượng. Bất tư lượng đệ như hà tư lương. Như hà tư lương. Phi tư lương tỳ thiền chi yếu giả. I said in Sino Vietnamese here. Phi tư lương tỳ. So this is the principle, the motto of Zen. Tư lượng cá bất tương lễ. To think about the thing that we cannot think about. So how can we think about the thing that we cannot think about? So not thinking is the principle of the Zen student. Not thinking. Not thinking is the principle of the Zen student. What they mean by not thinking is the complete movement, complete stopping of this movement of consciousness. They try to reach this ultimate, this final reality of complete non-movement of the consciousness. So, another direction of some of the Zen master, they think that why do we have to bother with this? Why do we have to bother with this ultimate reality that is an completely stop, completely non-movable, and we try to reach something and we just stay in there? And so they try to have another solution that is more feasible, more easy to apply, to be more practical in this life. And many people believe that perhaps this is the solution that the Buddha have approached. That we don't want to reach this final, ultimate things. We don't have to. So in the original Buddhism, many times people go back to the original Buddhism, the original teaching of the Buddha, and try to understand what the Buddha tried to offer to the world. And it was very clearly that it seemed like the Buddha aware of this reality, but he doesn't mind whether people be able to completely dwell in that reality or not. His interest is that in every moment, we can go back and to establish of the fullness of our mind by the practice of remembrance, of being mindful, being aware. And this, because as a human, we cannot be completely perfect. Regardless of how much we try, because life is impermanent, our body continues to change, our mind continues to change. So to reach for an absolute is something can be a good ideal, but it might not be so practical. Might not so be so practical. So we can satisfy with another solution to the problem of embracing this movement is that every moment we being aware of it, we allow its time to for it to process, then we can already have happiness as human being. The moment that we are mindful, we allow the body and the mind to unify, to allow different streams of consciousness to harmonize among itself, to allow its time for it to synchronize, then we can we don't have the best solution, but we have an optimized solution, a solution that we can use in the world. So we go to this question of a very practical issue. We go to this very practical issue. As a practitioner, we have touch some joy and some peace within us. Should we remain like that? Should we dwell in that space of joy and peace and just forget about whoever is doing what? We don't care what's happening to the world. Or should we go out and try to bring some peace and joy and to offer the people some fruit of our practice? This is a deep debate within a Persian, as well as within a tradition. Because we know the moment that even though we have a little bit of peace and joy within us, the moment that we go out to interact with other people, we try to help other people, right away we will be caught into this movement of consciousness. Because we, as human, we have individual karma, individual consciousness. But the moment that we get in touch with other people and try to help, right away, we will be involved in that collective consciousness, collective karma. And then, is our practice strong enough? As an individual practice, we ask ourselves, is our individual practice strong enough so that we can have some chance, some possibility to help to transform that the other collective consciousness? Can we, as a single man, single woman, we go out and we practice and we try to transmit it, when we have, is there any hope that collectively we can transform some collective consciousness? That is the deep question. The deep question. And it seemed like the Buddha had this debate within him after the enlightenment. He has this deep question. He keeps asking, should he go out and teach the world? Whether he remain in his state of joy and happiness, remain in his nirvana, and don't worry so much about the world. This is a debate that any enlightened being or someone who have awakened, who have able to search for the path, to have found the path, they will come, they will have to confront with this situation, with this debate, with this conflict within them. Because it's very easy to live alone, to have very simple kind of food, simple way of living, and then we just enjoy this little peace, little joy. But is it enough? Or as a fully awakened person, we need to make another step to go forward and to teach and to spread the teaching and to help with the society who's undergoing suffering right now. And it seems like many people who have reached that stage of enlightenment, they know that the world has a lot of suffering. The world might have a lot of doubt. The world might have a lot of violence. But they make the courage. They have the courage to go on, to step into the world and try to help the world. It seems to be like the path or the road that all of the enlightened beings have chosen that way. Instead of enjoying their own peace, their own little peace, their own little joy, they want to serve, they want to help the human society to transform together. And that is the something that we have to think about. In our case, we have the debate, should we remain in France or should we go into Germany to open an EIMB? That was a debate. It was a debate. It is nice to be in France, southern France, and then to enjoy life there and people come and practice with us and we continue to do that. Why do we have to bother to go here to Germany to set up another center? We have to fix this huge building with a lot of trouble. It seemed to be, it was my first choice to be in France. I was very sick when I returned from Vietnam, 2007. 2004, I begin the process of organizing and negotiation for Thai to go Vietnam, to go back to Vietnam. And 2007, we organized the grand Equium ceremony for the Vietnam War victim. And so 2007, I was somehow exhausted. Extremely exhausted and sick from those organizing for 3 years, in 3 years for two state trip. It was very demanding because, you know, like this movement of consciousness, if you live in the West, it can be a bit better. But if you are in a communist country, it can be very difficult to deal with. So I was trying my best to practice at the same time to serve and to organize, to help the wish of Thai to become a reality. At the end of the trip in 2007, when I went to Hong Kong, suddenly this part of my body in the back, my shoulder here, the moment I went to Hong Kong, I slept that night, I wake up, and suddenly I noticed this, that there's a big lump behind my shoulder here on the right side. It had been there for the last few days, or perhaps it had developed for the last few days, but perhaps I was so much involved with the work in Vietnam, I didn't pay attention to what's going on back there, or I was not fully aware. After a full night of rest in Hong Kong, in the morning, my back, my shoulder swelling, very big. After that, some of my friends took me to the doctor, and the dermatologist, he examined that, and he said that I have a tumor, and he advised me to use the antibiotic before it developed into something that we have to have operation. And he has I have to have it. Usually I don't, I want to use the practice to heal my body. And usually I don't want to use medicine, especially antibiotic to do it. So I was debating, and finally he was able to convince me to use the antibiotic. I went to the pharmacy, and I was sitting here, the counter was there, by like those red chairs. So my friend went into and bought the medicine. She brought out a bag of antibiotic that big. And I had to consume it in 2 weeks. I said, what? This much of antibiotic, the whole bag, and I have to consume in 2 weeks. I tell my friend, please return it. I don't want to use it. So, luckily I was there and the counter was there. In principle, we cannot return the medicine once we have brought it out of the counter. But we were there right in the front of the counter. So the man was kind enough to get it back, the medicine for us. Then after that, I went to Thailand. After the trip in Hong Kong, teaching tour in Hong Kong, we went to Thailand. I tried to my best to practice, to rest, and to allow my body to heal itself. When I go to Thailand, within like 2 weeks or so, this lump in the back of my shoulder disappeared. But then I begin to develop diarrhea. I have diarrhea and I continue to go to the toilet I couldn't stop it. I couldn't stop. I used the Thai medicine. Then I went back to Hong Kong. I tried to rest. And I tried to rest. But it continued on. And I went to some Chinese doctor. They give me some medicine. It stopped a little bit. Then it come back. Then I left Hong Kong. I go back to Plum Bliss. It was in June 2007. Thầy supposed to leave for Germany around 12 o'clock. I arrived at Bordeaux Airport around 8 o'clock or so. So I said, well, I would like to say goodbye to Thầy before he go to Germany. So I was waiting at the airport for Thầy. And when Thầy come to the airport, he asked me, Thap Ang, come and sit next to me. He said that Thầy is going to Germany today for the teaching tour. And we will go and look for a property in Rhine to set up the European Institute of Applied Buddhism. And you will be the director when we set it up. So be prepared and be prepared to go to Germany soon. I come back from Hong Kong. Thầy was not aware that I have this problem of diarrhea. I didn't tell him. And I was so tired, I was so exhausted. So Thầy was very happy and joyful when he shared with me that news. But I'm deep within myself, I'm very sad. I really don't want to go, and I don't want to be here at all. So it was a long process of struggling. During that summer 2007 and late 2007, I tried to convince Thai not to set up a center here. I tried to have all Cap region that so Thai doesn't have to set up a center here. Very interesting. And we have I was a bit because my body was sick, so I really didn't want to go on. I was very tired and exhausted, and I want to have this route to reach the ultimate reality, to be peaceful in that, and I don't want to go out and to share the teaching with the world. So there was time that I and Thai, we didn't talk to each other much. Usually I was very close to Thai, but during those months from the summer 2007 to the early 2008, I didn't come and talk to Thai much, because I know that the moment I come, he will bring up this topic. It will be difficult for me to receive and discuss. So I try to avoid him as much as possible. And one day I remember sometime a few days before Vietnamese New Year, in 2008, few days at the end of January. That year, the Vietnamese New Year was in the early February, so the end of January, Thay was walking by my room. He saw me inside the room. He a bit stepped back. So I go and open the door. I invite Thay to go into my room. So I bring a chair for him, and then I say with Thay that I see that we, you know, we do not have a lot of resource. Human resource is in, well, it's financial resource. Many things. We don't have many Dharma teacher available to go and teach, to set up. But and I think it would be a very difficult task. So but if Thay had decided to do that, then I will follow Thay, because it is a practice of a monk or a nun. Is the practice of obedience. You have to, we have to practice obey, because we have to listen to our teacher regardless of what he or he decided, because that is a, because he's our spiritual teacher. He's perhaps we have not reached his wisdom, his insight, and his deep compassion. We have not reached that level of deep compassion, that level of deep wisdom and insight. So sometimes a teacher might do something that we might not know, and we might not understand fully what he's doing. So as a student, one of the practice is we have to practice obedience. Even that we have a bright idea, a good idea, brilliant idea, very sound, logical idea, we still have to practice to listen to our spiritual teacher, because he has practiced, he has cultivated compassion, he has cultivated understanding, insight, and wisdom. He has gone through life, and he has gone through many hardships, so he has a lot of experience. So he might have decided something, but at first we think it's a good decision. We still have to take a trust. We have to practice to have a deep trust in the teacher and to follow him. We cannot say, I have this good idea and my teacher does not have this good idea, then forget it. No, we have to practice to follow him. If we still consider him as our teacher. And that is a very important practice of a spiritual student. It's very important. The moment that we say that we are right and our teacher is wrong, we break that relationship deeply. There's no more relationship because he cannot act as a spiritual guidance anymore. He cannot guide us because we don't have enough trust. We do not have enough faith into the teacher. How can he guide us? So this relationship is extremely important. We might have our own idea. We might have our own will. We might have our own wishes, our own direction. But we have to practice in such a way that we can be in harmony with our teacher. So that day, the end of January 2008, I explained to Thầy, and I would like to practice beginning new by touching the earth, three bow to him, and I say, that is your wish and your wisdom and your compassion, and if you have decided to go for it, then I would try my best to help. I would try my best to do it. So I touched the earth to Thầy three times, and then Thầy leave the room, and I continue to take good care of myself. I was very sick that winter. I continue to have acupuncture treatment for 3 months. I practice Qigong. I eat very simple food. I only have brown rice and sesame for almost the whole year before I return to a little bit of normal eating. And then slowly our body have a chance to regenerate and have a chance to heal itself. Our body, what it really needs is the time for it to relax. And what our body really needs is this relaxation so that it can heal itself. Our body have this capacity. It has a very deep capacity. Regardless of what illness that we have, we allow ourselves, allow our body, our mind to rest, to relax. It will do the work of transformation for us. We don't have to do anything much. We just allow it to be. And that is in my case. I practice a little bit of Qigong. I eat very simple food and try to relax as much as possible. And slowly, now I'm a bit recovered compared to a year and a half ago in early 2008. I'm in much better condition now without much of the medicine. I receive about 3 months of acupuncture, but that's it. The rest is self-practice and eating, simple eating. So when I and then very interestingly, after that beginning new, that night I had a very good sleep because there's so much tension and there's so much conflict. So the moment that we are able to do that cap act, then the conflict seemed to resolve and the tension seemed to resolve. So I had very good deep night of sleep. And the next morning I put the incense, I burned the incense to the Buddha, offered the incense to the Buddha. And in my room there's a table for the Buddha, and there's the incense odor like that. And after I burned the incense, I kneel down, and in this position, very interestingly, before I put the incense onto the incense holder, in this kneeling position, in my mind there's a sentence that our practice center or our institute will be in Bonn, not in Rhine. Will be somewhere close to Bonn, not in Rhine. Very interesting. I never thought about this. I never think about this center in Germany for the whole years or so. And Thầy and Sister Chang Khong and some of the friends here in Germany was looking for this place. But I didn't pay much attention and I don't even ask where it is. And that morning when I put the incense down, he said that our center will be close to Bonn, not Rhine. And I have no idea where Bonn is. I don't know. I have no idea where Rhine is in Germany. I don't even know the geography of Germany. And interesting enough, that day I went to lunch with Thầy. I went out to have lunch. Usually during the winter retreat, Thầy stay with us, and we have lunch together every day. So I went out and I told Thầy that this morning I put the incense down and there's a line in my head saying that our center will be close to Bonn, not in Rhine. I don't know where Bonn is and we don't know where's Rhine. They said that Thầy and Sister Chang Khong just received a call from Chị Thục Quyến that someone would like to introduce to her a place near Cologne. And then slowly it manifests out. And we are here, 1 hour from Bonn. Thầy has a deep wish to offer and to share the practice to many people in the world. I think he has a very deep compassion within him to share. And he has this strong ideal of offering of the practice. It's very amazing that he has this source of energy, regardless of how much difficult and difficulty that he might face. Like the situation of Pratnya Monastery in Vietnam. We know beforehand that if we open up a monastery in Vietnam, we will have to face this situation sooner or later, and we will have a lot of difficulty. Before going to Vietnam in 2005, again we have this debate, we have this conflict, because the communists, they are very tricky, and they are not very honest. The only way try to manipulate us. So in 2005, we have to cancel the trip. Before we go to Vietnam, we had to cancel it. But later on, we try to have the trip again. So so before we go to Vietnam in 2005, we had a lot of debate among the elder brother and sister that whether should we go to Vietnam or not to help with sharing the teaching and offering the teaching. It's very difficult. It's a very difficult environment, and but Thầy was very persistent that if we have a chance, then we should do it. And whatever the future will be, then let it be that so. But now we have opportunity to go back. We have opportunity to transmit the teaching. We have opportunity to help some people, even a few hundred people who receive the teaching. It's good. So I think that this is a spirit that I myself I have to learn, because I don't have this type of energy to go out and to offer and to share the teaching so much. I rather to be joyful, to be peaceful, and to enjoy my life quietly. But to go out and to serve and to help, it's something that is very deep. It's something that demands a very deep commitment within us. And how do we deal with the situation when a conflict arises, deeply arises? Remember that this movement of consciousness, the moment that we try to respond to it without clarity, without compassion and understanding, it will return to us. Just like when we throw a ball into a wall, and the ball just bounces back to us. But if we throw a ball into an empty space, then the ball will go on. So when we go out to the world, there will be conflict unavoidably, because the world is deeply involved in this movement of consciousness, where there's a lot of hatred, there's a lot of doubt, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of greed, and so on. So we have to go into this movement with a lot of emptiness in our heart. And we have to be ready to accept the consequence. People might not understand us. People might have doubt with us. People might have fearful energy toward us. And they might say untruthful things to us. How should we practice? We have to be practiced like an empty space and to absorb it without returning, without responding to many false accusations that people have done to us. The practice of noble silence is a practice, a very wonderful practice that helps to end all of these conflicts. Because the moment we begin to defend ourselves, we begin to try to defend ourselves, we fall into the trap of this movement of consciousness. So many times, usually in Plum Village, many people have false accusations toward us, toward Thai, or toward the brother and sister. They might say untruthful things, and we know very sure that what they say is not correct. Our practice is the practice of being silent. Many people ask, why don't we say back? Why don't we voice out what is truth? The problem is that this movement of consciousness can only be ended when the other person willing to end it. If the other person or the world doesn't want to end this conflict, it will create another movement. So there's no need and it's not necessary to try to respond to the world. Because the world will continue its movement. The world will continue to create another region, will create another accusation, and they will try to blame all kinds of things. So for many years, Thai's practice is to remain silent amid of many false accusations. During the time of the war in Vietnam, people accused him he's a communist, he's a anti-communist, he's a CIA agent. he's a cultural slave for the West who write and think to destroy the revolution in Vietnam. They said many bad things about Thai, and all kind of bad name, bad behavior, anything they can think of, they put it on Thai. Completely false, completely untrue. But Thai's practice is to remain silent. Because only by silence we can practice like an empty wall without the wall. We practice like emptiness. The ball will go through the wall and it will settle down. The moment we have the wall, the ball will bounce back, and it will continue to bounce back, and bounce back, and we'll never end it. So the same thing when we go home, we have a difficulty with our partner. And our partner might have misunderstood us, might have fear with us, might have doubt with us. In order to help him or her, we need to go back to practice, to embrace our own movement of consciousness and to allow it to settle. And don't worry about him or her. The moment his movement have done its own trajectory, there will be time that he will wake up from that movement, and there's a chance for both. The moment we try to defend ourselves, we try to explain things, but we don't have enough that emptiness within us, we do not have enough that depth of compassion and love within us, that can cause more damage than be helpful. So to understand the movement of our consciousness, to understand the movement of consciousness of the world, and learn to embrace it, to allow it to settle, is our practice. And this practice can be done with the energy of mindfulness, to allow our body, our mind, to be completely relaxed. Thank you.